This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Oliver Morton, writing for The Economist magazine about the thinking of James Lovelock, a man who worked with JPL in the 1960s, a man who was a physician but also keen on chemistry for discerning life on planets. And our own planet started with what you'd have to say complete radical conditions different from where we are now. From about 4.5 billion years ago is the general assumption that that's when we looked for the accretion of the planet. Perhaps between 4.5 and 4, we had the collision with the Mars-like planet, the creation of the moon. But I want to get on to the fact, as Oliver Morton says, we had almost no oxygen about between 4 and 3 billion years ago. So where did the oxygen come from, Oliver?
The oxygen came on Earth, came from the highest evolved form of photosynthesis, which is photosynthesis in which creatures, and today we know them as cyanobacteria, if they're bacteria, and algae and plants, if they're bigger things, which can split up water molecules to make hydrogen and oxygen, and they can stick the hydrogen into carbon dioxide to make carbohydrates, and that's what all the Earth's, almost all the Earth's biomass comes from. And they get rid of the oxygen, and it just percolates away. And when this started, the oxygen didn't get very far because the environment was very avid for oxygen, so it all got used up quickly. But there came a point sometime a bit after 2.5 billion years ago when the oxygen basically broke its bounds and got up into the atmosphere. And that's arguably the single most radical change in the way the Earth acts and looks since its early formation, because it changes the sort of minerals you have, it changes the chemistry of the oceans, it even changes the color of the sky, probably, because before there was oxygen in the sky, there would have been sort of like permanent hazes of complicated, simple, but complex in some ways, hydrocarbons. So you see this in the atmosphere of Titan, which is one of the moons of Saturn. There would have been these permanent hazes. Afterwards, after oxygen had got up and sort of like acted a bit like bleach, the sky was clear enough to be blue. So the development of oxygen, it's a radical change in the way that the Earth system works, and strong evidence for the fact that how the Earth is habitable depends on its inhabitants. And that's a key Lovelock insight.
The snowball Earth followed the rapid oxidization. And that is an aspect that we've been through cycles of advance and retreat of the ice. But I'm not pursuing geology. I'm pursuing living things. You say that there may be a connection between the maximum oxygenation of the atmosphere and the creation of creatures that we can recognize about 700 million years ago. Is that correct?
Yes, though this is a very complicated story, and I don't think anyone would claim to have it fully worked out yet. But there's pretty good evidence that big, complicated creatures with fast metabolisms really do need oxygen, and that the oxygen level, having spiked briefly in the great oxidation event I was just talking about, fell back down. And there were sort of like a billion years in which, from an evolutionary point of view, as far as we can see from fossils, nothing much happens. In fact, some paleontologists call this period the boring billion. But then towards the end of that, we start seeing stepwise changes in oxygen levels and methane levels, and quite how these are creating the conditions for life, and quite how they're responding to conditions created by changes in the way life works. That seems to me one of the most interesting and still quite open set of questions in Earth history. And it's interesting that one of Jim Lovelock's most distinguished and devoted followers, Tim Lenton of the University of Exeter, is very interested in this question of the details of how life and climate and the chemistry of the atmosphere and the behavior of rocks all come together in those crucial 200 million years just before you start finding evidence of big animals.
Then we come to the flora and fauna, and the rise of trees and plants. And that is the photosynthesis and the respiration cycle that also is evident in our atmosphere. And I'm just evidencing all of this because these are the signposts. I conclude from reading your essay, Oliver, that we need to look for in exoplanets. Do we have the instrument in the James Webb that can find these chemical signatures that would tell us whether our atmosphere is in chemical equilibrium, like Mars, where there is indication of no life, and chemical disequilibrium, such as ours? Is that available now for testing out all this hypothesis?
You would have to find a planet to look at that was very close. I mean, not around the Earth, around the same sun as the Earth orbits, and, but in a very close system to be able to definitively say something like that with the James Webb telescope. And you might need to find a way to, and I think you would need to find a way to block out the light from the star it was orbiting. Actually, there are a number of ways that you might think about doing it. I think the James Webb is a little bit, is not quite right. If that is going to do some fascinating exoplanet work, I'm not sure that it will. It would have to be very lucky to find an atmosphere that was where it could show a strong disequilibrium. That at least is my understanding. And it's also important to remember that that Lovelock was more subtle about this than some people who quote him have been. Disequilibrium is a sign of life. It's not only, it can be caused by other ways. If you like, the chemistry of chemical disequilibrium has to be caused by something from, as it were, another science. And there are ways in which physics can cause disequilibrium in an atmosphere. When Venus was losing its water at the point when Venus's climate changed very catastrophically sometime in the past, its atmosphere would have been in disequilibrium. It's not, and it's certainly not just a matter of finding an atmosphere with oxygen. There are various ways to get oxygen into a planetary atmosphere. The key point is to have steady levels of two things that really react strongly together. And that's why for Lovelock, it was always oxygen and methane. That was the one he really zoomed in on early on. And that's the one that's kept up. I don't expect that the James Webb will be able to provide a definitive sighting like that. I'd love to be proved wrong. But I think instruments that are now being developed both for the next generation of ground-based telescopes, which are, remember, far, far larger than the James Webb. The European Extremely Large Telescope is 30 meters across. Those might be able to do something like this. I always remember when thinking about this, some very wise words said to me by my friend Kevin Zarnley, who works at NASA Ames Research Center, where he said, the thing about planets with oxygen and signs of life in their atmosphere is the number of those planets is the single most interesting thing about the universe, which we know how to discover. And I think that's true. I think finding out how many planets there are that give us the signs that suggest that they have moderately advanced life on them, that's a question that is both fascinating and, with today's technology, answerable.
Oliver Morton, writing for The Economist magazine, in praise of James Lovelock, 1919 to 2022, the Gaia hypothesis with emendations here in the 21st century, the search for something that resembles what Earth looked like 2.5 billion years ago or 700 million years ago. And this from Lucretius, the Roman poet: desist from thrusting out reasoning from your mind because of its disconcerting novelty. Weigh in, rather, with a discerning judgment. Then, if it seems to you true, give in. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.